Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Perhaps the most alarming aspect of inequality is unequal access to justice. Young men of color are more likely than their white counterparts to be picked up, locked up, and prosecuted for suspected criminal offenses. The jury is more likely to find him guilty. The prosecutor is more likely to ask for a stiff sentence, and the judge is more likely to impose it. In this program, we'll talk about access to justice. We'll hear first from Adam Foss. Adam is a prosecutor in Boston and president of Prosecutor Impact. After he speaks, he'll be joined by Carol Bogart, president of the Marshall Project, and Glenn Martin, founder of Just Leadership USA. This event was recorded at our Global Philanthropy Forum. The broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to Adam Foss, president of Prosecutor Impact.
So this morning, we're talking about something that has not really been covered here at the conference, and that's race disparity in our country and what that means for outcomes for young people. And first, I want everyone in the room just to look around. Actually do it. Look around at who's here. Representing global philanthropy worldwide. And now think about who's not here. And think about where they might be. You all are wonderful people, very talented, very committed to these issues. The population of people that is not here are no less talented, no less intelligent, no less motivated. They are just impeded from being here because they are physically behind bars or there are collateral consequences in their lives of our justice system that keeps them from being here. And this is happening in our country. 50 years ago, people who looked like me lived in terror, the kind of terror that we ascribe to other countries, Syria, Turkey, Iraq, Afghanistan. They were bombed and battered and bruised. They were segregated. They were separated. They were denigrated. They were murdered and lynched without the protection of law enforcement, and indeed, sometimes with the complicity of law enforcement. And today we sit back and we look at the images of that period of time and we think to ourselves, how could we have let that happen? How could we have let that happen? How could we let four little girls get bombed in a church and nothing come out of it? How could we let a 15-year-old boy get battered beyond recognition and killed and nothing happened? How could we let people get mowed down by fire hoses and attacked by dogs and nothing happened? Children getting arrested coming out of school and filling up jails. How could we have let that happen? How could we let people stand around and watch as our brothers and sisters were hung from trees as if it was a public assembly? How could we have let that happen? I never would have let that happen. If we're going to trust each other, if we're going to have truth and reconciliation, then we need to state the obvious, and that we're kind of doing that right now. There are 2.3 million people in our jails and prisons, and despite making up only 14% of the population, almost 50% of the people in jail and prison look like me. One in three black men born today will spend some time in a correctional facility in their lifetime. The two men that you have on the panel today have already done their time. One in three black women has a relative in prison right now. There are 7 million people under correctional control in this country. One misstep, and I say misstep, not misdeed, misstep, from being incarcerated. 70 million people have criminal records. That's one out of every four Americans. And there are 50,000 collateral consequences to convictions that impede people from successfully reentering society. There are more African Americans in prison now than there were slaves on the eve of the Civil War. There are more segregated schools in this country than there were on the eve of Brown versus Board of Education. There was more representation in the United States Congress during Reconstruction than there is now. And yet here we sit talking about solving problems outside of our borders. Who are we to go clean other people's houses when ours is such a mess and we can't trust each other enough to talk about it? It's time for a new civil rights movement. This isn't a secret to anybody. African Americans have been saying this for decades, and a lot of the inertia is blamed on a lack of leadership. We're looking for another Martin, we're looking for another Malcolm, we're looking for another Rosa, somebody, anybody to take us to the promised land, and yet nothing happens. So I challenge the folks in the audience, it's not a question of who is going to be the next civil rights leader, it's a question of what am I going to do in my individual capacity to right these wrongs. Not what am I going to do next year, what am I going to do in Q3 or Q4, what am I going to do tonight to have a realistic conversation about the state of our union? There's something that you, each one of you, can do at any point in time. Because it's not just about the back end and people who are going into the prisons, it's about what happens when you are born. We know that children in utero whose mother is suffering from toxic stress inherit that toxic stress, and that is a direct pathway to the criminal justice system. We know in our communities that children in Massachusetts, for example, 75% of the children who are locked up in our Department of Youth Services have had, on average, 3 interactions with the child welfare system by the time they were 3 years old. I'm going to say that again. 75% of the children who are locked up in our Department of Youth Services and our juvenile jail had, on average, 3 interactions with the child welfare system by the time they were 3. Those are babies telling us, if you don't do something, I'm going to end up in jail. And we wait. Those children, by the time they reach the first grade, have heard 30 million less words than those in more affluent suburbs. Put in another way, those children, on average, from the time that they are born until the time they reach the first grade, have been read to 18 hours. In the suburbs, that number is 2,400 hours. That gap in literacy, that gap in cognitive development, that gap in just the physical and emotional support provided by a parent creates a direct pathway to the criminal justice system. Those children then go on to middle school. And having not learned how to read, they have a really hard time learning from reading. And what do we do as adults? We punish them. Because they're acting up in our classrooms, because they're walking around, because they're a behavior problem, they're the class clown, we punish them. Then those children go on into high school, having not learned how to read, how to not learn from reading, the chance that they drop out of high school is through the roof. 68% of state prisoners are high school dropouts. That is not just a correlative factor, that's a causal relationship. But we wait. Because when they drop out, those kids go out as adolescents and they find other people that are just like them. They find other people that aren't judging them for their deficits. They find other people who they respect and they're loyal to and they love and they get that love back. And in the suburbs, we call those things a team, a troop, a club. But in my neighborhood, we call that a gang. Despite the fact that it's completely normative adolescent behavior, we label it, we racialize it, and we demonize it. And because their lifestyle is decided by who lives and who dies, am I going to walk down the street and get killed? Are my friends going to walk down the street and get killed? When they respond to that with violence, something that they've learned in their own homes, then as adults, we say, now I have time for you. Now I have resource for you. We send them to our criminal justice system. We spend all of our time, all of our resource, and all of our energy locking that person up for the rest of their lives at a cost to all of us. We need to have this conversation all the time, because 50 years from now, we're going to be looking back on this time. And when that time comes, it's not going to be the words of our enemies that remember. It's going to be the silence of all of us. And so as you listen to this panel, I want you to think about, in 50 years from now, how do you want to be remembered? Do you want to be remembered as the person who did lots of things all over the world but ignored what was going on in your backyard? Or do you want to be remembered as somebody who got fed up that this is happening on your watch and you did something because you were one of the new civil rights leaders of our time? Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So here we are at the plenary session, Race, Justice, and Legitimacy in America. I would like to welcome our web audience as well. Good morning. Thank you for being there, if you're there. If you're live tweeting, please use the hashtag GPF17 for all you kids. I have joining me on the panel today two amazing speakers, one of whom is a close personal friend, the second of whom I hope will be my close personal friends. Their bios are in the book, but I'll start us off here. First, I'd like to welcome Carol Bogert. She's the president of the Marshall Project. If you all have your phones out, I see some of you do, I would like you to just go ahead and download or follow the Marshall Project. Marshall Project seeks to create and sustain a sense of national urgency about the criminal justice system. It's real news. And it's the youngest news organization to ever win the Pulitzer Prize. Ms. Bogert was previously Deputy Executive Director at Human Rights Watch, running its award-winning global media operations for 18 years. Please give it up for Carol Bogert. And before this next individual comes out, he's very handsome. A year ago, this individual stood on the steps of City Hall in New York City and said he would have Rikers closed in 12 months, and everybody laughed in his face, but we are happy to report that the mayor last couple weeks ago said that he was going to do that, and it is in no small part to the efforts of this man. Glenn Martin is the founder and president of Just Leadership USA, an organization predicated on the belief that the formerly incarcerated can best contribute to the effective policy reform. In 2016, his efforts were recognized with the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award. Prior to founding Just Leadership, he was the vice president of the Fortunate Society, one of the most respected reentry organizations in the country. Please give it up for my brother, Glenn Martin. Hi. So really small issue. That we're going to deal with this morning, race, justice, inequality in America, new hot button topic. So, Carol, I would like to start with you. What's the problem?
Wow. I actually think you just did a masterful job laying out what the problem is and socking it to all of us to get busy on a solution. So that was an amazing litany of statistics, but I think they add up to, as you said, what the Marshall Project is trying to do, which is to raise and sustain a sense of national urgency about this issue. It goes on in the background of our lives, constantly in our society, and it's something we've been able to ignore, and particularly something that white people have been able to ignore because it's not impacting white communities in the same way. And that is simply not something we can tolerate. I spent 18 years of my life at Human Rights Watch. There are colleagues of mine from Human Rights Watch here. It's one of the great NGOs of the world. It has impact all over the world. But I couldn't not spend some part of my life engaged in the most critical human rights struggle in the United States, which is the criminal justice system. When you look at human rights abuse around the world, again and again, it is in the justice sector. It is in the sector in which the government arrogates to itself the right to use violence against its citizens and to take away their liberty. It's not surprising that that power is often abused. In this country, it is also abused regularly and in ways that we too often ignore. So, how can journalism help? I was a foreign correspondent before I came to Human Rights Watch, and I remained a journalist kind of in my bones, but I am also a human rights activist. And in many countries around the world, these are the same thing. If you go to a country that's living under dictatorship, the journalists there are human rights activists. They have to be, because the essential human right of freedom of speech is rapidly taken away in situations of authoritarian rule. And I think we're seeing now, not to go super political on you so early in the morning, but we do have an administration that has identified journalists as enemies of the people. And frankly, as somebody who lived in the former Soviet Union for 5 years, that's a really creepy term. And it signifies the importance of media in raising issues that are critical of governance. As an advocate at Human Rights Watch, I was aware, and I was in charge, of making media coverage central to our advocacy. Yes, there are many things that advocates do in closed-door sessions with policymakers that have nothing to do with media. But a lot of where Human Rights Watch derived its impact was from being in the press day after day. And what we're trying to do at the Marshall Project is keep issues of the criminal justice system in the media day after day. So we're a newsroom. We have 10 reporters. We're still small. And we work in partnership with mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, and smaller publications, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Vice, a great partner actually, Wired, Ebony. We do long-form investigative journalism, and then we publish it with mainstream media, who have a bigger audience than a startup media organization like us can have. And it does have impact. Sometimes it's direct impact. We published a story with the Washington Post about a month ago now about the phenomenon in many states in this country. If your kid is sent to jail, you, the parent, will get a bill. You will be asked to pay for their lodging and for their incarceration. You can imagine what this is like for families who are already struggling with poverty to additionally be asked to pay the state for the trauma that their child is experiencing in prison. So the lead example in the story, the first paragraph, was a guy employed by the city of Philadelphia. He was making $319,000 a year, and it was his job to sit across the table from these impoverished parents and say to them, okay, you owe us now. We published the story, you know, in the morning, went live on the Post site at, you know, whatever, 4, 6 a.m. By noon, the city of Philadelphia had announced that it was abandoning that practice. So
can we give it up for the Marshall Project? For that? So I want to, Glenn, I want to turn to you. First, I know you were behind the curtain, but I also want you to observe the room. And talk to me about what happens when we let formerly incarcerated people run wild after we close down Rikers.
Why does she get the softball question? So that's a really good question, actually. So let me give you a little bit of history of the Rikers campaign, because when people hear me say we should shut down Rikers, first of all, it was a very lonely place a year ago when I first said that. But as someone who went to Rikers at age 16 for a shoplifting charge with $1,500 bail and was there for 2 days, I think the judge was trying to teach me a lesson. And on the second day on my way back to court, I was in a cell that was meant to hold maybe about 20 people. There were about 50 people there. This is a prison, this is a jail that had 22,000 people at that time. It was always meant to only hold about 14,000. So you can imagine what that was like. People were double bunked, triple bunked, and so on. And so I'm on my way back to court, and a young guy walks up to me, another child. I'm very deliberately using the word child because we were both children. And he said, give me your jacket. And if you know anything about Rikers Island, they call it gladiator school for a reason. You have two choices, predator or prey. There's not much in between. And we started to fight. And by the time that fight was over, I got stabbed 4 times in that cell. The last time in my neck, it was a pen that was melted and fashioned into a knife. And yet I emerged from that fight realizing I can survive in this jail. And so that really is the lesson New York City taught me as a 16-year-old child who's trying to figure out my identity and where I fit into this world, that this is what New York City has for me. And yet Rikers is every jail, and every jail is Rikers. And so when I decided to launch this organization and figure out how we were going to help decarcerate this country, because I'm located in New York, for me it was an easy decision to decide that we would take on the most bold and audacious campaign. Why? Because when we listen to people who've been harmed most by the criminal justice system, they were clear with us that reform wasn't good enough, and that this particular institution has shown itself to be resistant to reform. We spent $209,000 per bed per year to abuse our children in this place. There's 10 jails. 80% of the people there are innocent, just charged with a crime, not convicted, 89% people of color. So when people say, well, how do you do
can you
that?
Just say that? Can you just say that again? Because we're in New York City, and there are white people there.
Yeah.
So can you talk to me just about that percentage that you just said again?
Sure. So I'll restate those statistics. I think I sort of brushed over them. 80% of the people who are sitting at Rikers on any given day are just charged with a crime, and they spend anywhere from a day to 6 years charged with a crime, not convicted. So the punishment is in the process. No matter what happens at the end of that experience, if the DA drops the charges, if a person gets convicted, the fact of the matter is that they've already been punished. And for me, that punishment was 4 stab wounds that I still deal with today. I'm standing online at the supermarket and I feel the pain in my back from where the pen punctured my muscles, you know, 30 years later. And so we built a campaign that invested in the leadership of people like me, people who've been through the system. Why? Because we knew they would show up. And most importantly, and this is what I appreciated about your talk, first of all the statistics, I just had to keep scratching off all the things that were going to make me sound smart. Thank you, Adam. But when you got to the point of humanizing the issue, when you talked about the community you're from and how people engage in the very same behaviors that other folks engage in, and yet it's defined differently, that really resonated with me the most. Because the problem with our criminal justice system is that you don't get to the point where you criminalize 70 million Americans unless you dehumanize them first. Right. And so we have to spend a ton of time rehumanizing folks in the criminal justice system. Right now we talk about prisoners, convicts, ex-offenders, inmates. You can put those things in a cell for 23 hours a day. Those are not brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, children. Those are inmates. What's an inmate? Put an inmate in a cell for 23 hours. I'm okay with that. Spend $209,000 per bed per year locking it up, because I'm scared of that. And so that's what's been so amazing about the system, its ability to cause so much human carnage and at the same time have so many Americans be okay with it, because it's not our sisters and brothers, it's inmates and convicts and prisoners.
Carol, Glenn's point about words is something that's really important, especially in this conversation where we have racialized a lot of the criminal justice system. Can you talk a bit about the media's role in that happening, what is failing right now in the media, and what, how you look at this issue differently?
Yeah, I think it would be worthwhile, and maybe somebody's already done a PhD thesis on this, but to look at the media coverage in, say, the 1990s when the 94 crime bill was passed and where a lot of mass incarceration really got turbocharged, and to really analyze how bad media got us into this mess and how crime scare, television in particular, drove this kind of politics. Because I think it did. I can't prove it to you, but I'm sure if somebody did that academic study, it would bear those instincts out. You know, we struggle sometimes with issues of the lexicon, of what terms to use. We don't use the term ex-con. We were in San Quentin about a year ago meeting with a group of inmates, and they were discussing how they wanted to be called. what term did they want to be used for them? And one of the younger guys was advocating for the term incarcerated Americans. We were like, oh, yeah, that's kind of a little bit cumbersome. And an older guy said to him, dude, we call each other inmate. So, you know, this is a constant struggle to find the right kinds of words to describe this problem and to do it honestly and not to demonize others. And I wouldn't say that's an easy issue.
Can I follow up on that just really quickly?
Yes, please.
I think the transition I've seen over the last few years with respect to media has spent a lot of time reporting on crime, right? If it bleeds, it leads. But what I've seen more recently, and obviously the Marshall Project has led on this, is now we're reporting about the criminal justice system and the juvenile justice system. Those stories weren't happening before. We weren't educating Americans about how this system operates as a human grist mill, essentially. And instead, what Americans were hearing is not the formerly incarcerated person who did 6 years in prison, earned a college degree, and now employs 20 people and runs an institution. What you hear about is the guy who got out and screwed up. And that's always going to happen. That story's always going to be available. And I find that the media now has finally realized, I don't know if there was a sort of come to Jesus moment, if you will, but definitely there's been a turning point where the media understands the importance of writing about the system.
I think that's true. I hope that's true. But I would say that this issue is coinciding with another huge crisis in our country, which is completely separate, which is the crisis of the media. So we have twin incredibly important challenges right now. One is there's no commercial model that really works to support serious investigative journalism. It's just too expensive. You know, a couple of the majors, the New York Times and the Washington Post, managed to fund it. But, you know, the Washington Post has Jeff Bezos's money, and the New York Times, has some issues of its own. Everybody is struggling to find the wherewithal, the reporters, to cover stories, and investigative stories in particular, you know, you take months. Sometimes you have reporters working on a story for years. Then at the same time, we have this crisis of legitimacy. We have a president who's calling us enemies of the people, and we have a trust issue. I think, I would analogize it to the way people feel about their congressmen. Like, if you ask people, how do you feel about Congress? Almost all Americans will say, oh, my God, you know, it's a nightmare. They can't get anything done. But when you ask people, how do you feel about your individual congressman? A lot of people will say, oh, I love my guy. You know, he's great. So I think that's often also true of the media. People demonize the media. The media are a nightmare. They're silly. They're superficial. They're terrible. But the thing I read, I really like. But having said that, we do face a real a crisis of people lining up behind the media that support their point of view. And the challenge, I think, for us right now, the New York Times is doing a good job covering the criminal justice system. The Marshall Project is doing its best. But what about those local TV stations or the talk radio that's not focusing on this issue? How do we get other people to care?
So I don't want to absolve all these smart people of their responsibility in this. How important is the media when you look around? I mean, look in this room. There are like 5 black people here driving through D.C. and going from one neighborhood to this one where life expectancy goes up by 10 years. Driving through neighborhoods where at all hours of the day there are people in the streets who are looking for opportunity, who are looking for employment. And finally, this lexicon of low-level nonviolent offender, which has taken on such a nice ring in the wake of the opiate crisis. How much do we hide behind the non-reporting of these issues, and how much are we just sort of ignoring a problem that's been there forever?
So I've been out of prison for 15 years, struggled with all the collateral consequences that anyone else with a criminal record would face in this country, all the way up until 2.5 years ago, being invited to the White House and being unable to get in as a result of a 21-year-old conviction.
That's in the United States, right? I just want to make that clear.
It's right down the block.
All right.
With a black president at the time who cared about this issue, who invited me to the White House. So everyone gets a life sentence in our criminal justice system. That's worth saying. I don't care what you get when you stand in front of that judge. The collateral consequences, the scarlet letter of a criminal record, means you actually never get away from that. At sentencing, there's this ceremony that knocks people down a few notches. You're no longer like us. You're going to go to this institution. There's going to be barbed wire and a wall, and you're going to stay there, and you're different than us. And there's no ceremony to bring people back up. We leave them there. So that's worth saying out loud. So I've been out for 15 years. It took me about that long to demystify how to get into spaces like this. The same racial bias, the same systemic inequities, all the things that we fight as folks who want to see a better world exists in the space of nonprofit / philanthropy. I mean, I run an institution now with a $3.5 million budget. Half of that is funded by one funder, which means the other half is funded by the other 27 funders. Imagine what it's like to navigate those 27 relationships to raise $1.5 million. And yet I've worked at larger institutions run by Ivy League educated white colleagues who are doing amazing work, but who get much different outcomes when they're engaging philanthropy. And so the thing I'd like to plant in the minds of the people in this audience, whether you're working domestically or internationally, is that, you know, the people who by definition make it to your front door may not be the people who are closest to the ground. At Just Leadership USA, we say people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, but furthest from power and resources. And in addition to our leadership training to invest in the leadership of people most impacted, we spend a lot of time thinking about proximity of people who have been devastated by the criminal justice system to people who have the resources, the wherewithal, the access, the power, the privilege to help them solve those problems. And how do we bridge that gap, including bringing in people like the Secretary of State, the Darren Walker, the head of the Ford Foundation, like all these relationships that it took me 15 years to develop. I don't want to see that happen for other leaders all across the country who have great ideas about how to end mass incarceration. And so I hope that that's one important takeaway that this audience gets from this conversation is that not to not invest in institutions that exist that are doing good work, but to also figure out how you create a space for people who are closest to the ground to have the sort of access that took me over a decade to get.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We just heard from Adam Foss of Prosecutor Impact. He was then joined by Carol Bogert of the Marshall Project and Glenn Martin of Just Leadership USA. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Adam Foss.
I really appreciated what you said earlier about still dealing with your wounds. Because one thing that really bothers me about the conversation around criminal justice, and to be fair, the last administration perpetuated the issue for me, is that it was framed around low-level nonviolent people. And the new thing in criminal justice is segmenting the populations of low-level nonviolent to violent offenders. Given what we know in this audience about toxic stress and about young people dealing with violence, could you just briefly touch upon, we have a couple seconds left, so briefly touch upon how do we get beyond that conversation and really talk about driving down prison population?
Sure. So my organization has the goal of cutting the number of people under correctional supervision in this country in half by 2030. And people are like, how did you get there? Part of it is that people directly impacted felt as though the field was highly incremental, not being super bold, and didn't have the sense of urgency that the communities that are most impacted want to see coming from the field. And then the other part was I have a three-year-old son at the time, Joshua, and he's going to be 18 in 2030, and he has a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison. And I think of the wounds I carry with me, but I also know this stuff is generational for poor communities and communities of color. And so for me, I wanted to wake up every day with the urgency of not having Joshua experience the sort of trauma that I experienced years ago that I continue to carry with me today, and for him not to have his physical being have to deal with the trauma of the experience in the criminal justice justice system. And so I think one of the most important things I bring to the table as someone who's become sort of a spokesman on this issue is that I went to prison for a violent crime. I mean, I went to prison for robbery. I was sitting on a panel next to the Manhattan DA about 3 years ago, and he stopped me in the middle of my talk and said, well, you said a lot about reentry and people coming home and the supports they need and so on, but what about the victims? And I was like, you know, DA Vance, with all due respect, I didn't learn how to pull a gun on someone until someone pulled a gun on me.
Right.
And when I was the victim of a crime, you didn't have a lot of interest in me. I wasn't a deserving victim.
Right.
And you know what happens when people are victimized? It turns into trauma, and that trauma calcifies, and then it manifests itself as offending behavior. And then we spend $209,000 per bed per year.
Right.
So until we bridge that, and I think the media is doing a pretty good job of helping to make that bridge, I think that we don't get to the finish line because we continue to hold on to the narratives that we've been given that helped us to get to where we are today.
And then when somebody does offend, we send them to a place that obviously treats that trauma and doesn't teach them a bunch of negative maladaptive skills to be out in the street.
You caught the irony there, people.
That was sarcasm. I'm going to give you the last word before Q&A. Given everything that you've heard, what is one ask that you would have of the audience when they leave here today?
Go to prison. I'm not kidding. It's not that hard. Go to prison. It'll be one of the experiences of your life. It's not that hard. San Quentin's like in Marin. Sing Sing, you can take Metro North. Wherever you live, it is possible. Go to the county, go to night court. Just go look. Because I work at the Marshall Project. I read about this stuff every day. I write about it myself. When I go to a prison and I see how many black men are there, it's just a different feeling to see it. It hits you in the gut. You can't believe your eyes, and you won't be the same afterwards. Do that. The people in prison are invisible to you. You've got to go, and you can do it.
We're going to open it up for Q&A, and then we're going to go have a very nice breakfast. Yes, ma'am.
I recently saw a documentary, 13th, and I would love your comments on it. And I want to give credit there because I saw it at an Echoing Green Fellows meeting because several Echoing Green Fellows have been supported to work in this field. And secondly, I want to give a shout out because we're here in Washington, D.C. There is an emergency room doctor, Dr. Jeffrey Mount Varner. He has just self-published a book, the title of which is Getting Home Alive, because he has a son and a daughter and he's black. And he figured they have to have this book. And it's incredibly well written, and I really think we ought to get it out there. I'm glad to get copies for anyone who wants it.
Amazing. By show of hands, how many of you have seen The 13th? Okay. For the rest of you, it's on Netflix. Go see it. For me, the response to that question is the distribution of it was genius, because if Netflix had been something that was released in a movie theater, most of you wouldn't have gone and seen it because it's an issue that we'd like to not acknowledge. You perhaps recognize a handsome face from the movie on this stage. So I'm going to go to him, ask him what he thinks.
I think that I was in a film that was nominated for a freaking Oscar, first of all. I'm put that on my resume.
This violent criminal that is up here was in a film nominated for an Oscar. Go.
Yeah, no, look, I think it was genius. I remember when I sat in that warehouse in the Bronx with Ava doing that filming, and I didn't have any sense of where the project was going. I think what she did was the film version of Michelle Alexander's
yes.
book, if you will. For people who don't read, here was a chance to sit in front of a television and learn in a couple of hours what most of us know and hear and deal with every single day. And what was most powerful for me is the amount of phone calls I got afterwards from people who were motivated to do something. I mean, we're always trying to activate people to boots on the ground, get up and figure out what to do. And it just inspired a generation to finally get involved. And that's what I appreciated about it the most.
One more little plug, since we're making plugs for... Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. I think that's a book that has changed many Americans' lives, opened people's eyes. The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander is certainly another one. And if you don't like to read books, just watch 13th. Yeah.
So I'm going to be the skunk of the garden party and push back a little bit. The film was incredible, except it mentioned the word prosecutor three times, and one of them came out of his mouth. You can't have a film about mass incarceration without talking about the role of the prosecutor. And the thing that I really impress upon people is, at the end of the 13th, I feel like a lot of people felt helpless because you're talking about things like ALEC and the private prison industry and all these lobbies that we as individual citizens don't have a lot of influence on. Prosecutors, mass incarceration is an admission problem. Prosecutors are the people who admit people to prison. Somebody looked at Glenn Martin and said, you're a robber, instead of looking at an individual and saying, there's potential in you that might lead to something else, so let's think about not sending you to prison as a robber. And the reason that you are empowered to do something about that is that next year, there will be 1,000 DA elections in this country. 95% of incumbent DAs stay in office. 85% run unopposed, and the turnout for those elections is 10%. It is the most important election, if you care about this issue, in your lifetime. And so find out who your prosecutor is, what they're doing, what their philosophies are, and vote. Next question. Yes, all the way in back. Couldn't see you, sorry.
That's right. I was just wondering if there's anything being done at law schools around the country on this issue, and in particular on the behavior and training of prosecutors.
Is that a plant? Do I know you? So the first day that I started as a prosecutor, I stood around 12 really, really excited people who were excited to do something good and to change the community, make it safer. But we didn't know how to do that. And we were asking for people to go to jail, many of us never having been there. We were deciding the lives and the fates of black people, having actually never met one. And so the law schools are really struggling to figure out how do we make money and teach people subjects that will help them prepare for the bar, and then how do we actually do this thing called justice. So I'm actually working on a project now to go around the country training new prosecutors about lots of things that have nothing to do with the law but everything that have to do with our justice system. It's negligent that we allow our lawyers to go out and start doing these things when the capital is human lives without knowing anything about humans or lives.
As someone who's always thinking about proximity, we spend a lot of time creating spaces for our fellows across the country to speak at law schools. In fact, when we launched Just Leadership USA and we had to create this leadership training, we started tabula rasa and assumed that we didn't know anything about what formerly incarcerated leaders needed across the country. I didn't want to just trust my own experience. And we partnered with the law school at Columbia, in fact, because we saw value in that. We knew that we would get resources from the institution itself. And at the same time, we also knew that the students and the folks who would help us with the research would, their cultural competency would be enhanced on this particular issue as a result of the interviews that we did with formerly incarcerated leaders all across the country, which led to a report that helped us to create the curriculum for our year-long Leading with Conviction training.
You use the word, and Brian is the one who really brought this to the forefront. It's about proximity. And when you have people who go from affluent middle schools and high schools and colleges and law schools, it's really difficult for them to get a sense of what's going on out here. So I really want to drive home what Carol said. Like, the courthouse is a public place. And instead of maybe going in early to the office or going to yoga or going to Starbucks, go to your local courthouse or go to a courthouse that's actually not in your community. And see if, as consumers of the criminal justice system, you're getting your bargain. More questions?
There's one over there.
One over there. I'm just going to point in the general direction.
Hi, I'm Tina Rosenberg from the Solutions Journalism Network and the New York Times. I want to talk about the media aspect of this. And I love the Marshall Project's work. I'm a huge fan. And some of the stories that they've done that I think are most important and persuasive are ones that not only investigate and expose the problems, but also look at who's doing a good job in solving them. For example, a story on money bail that had described the Washington, D.C. system and had quotes from officials saying, we don't need money bail to make our system work. We can do without it, and we have done without it. And I think, Carol, you're right. And criminal justice is not only a unique issue in that there is some bipartisan consensus on it, it's also unique in that there has been a lot of movement over the past few years in states to reduce mass incarceration and to improve things. To me, the challenge of getting, basically, to put it bluntly, to get white people to read about the criminal justice system and inform themselves about the criminal justice system is twofold. One is, you're talking about, as you guys say, the other. That's not us. I don't care about them. The other part is, it's painful. I don't want to read or watch movies about stuff that is constantly going to tell me how awful the world is and that there's no hope, which is why I think it's so effective when you guys do stories that say, here is this big problem, but yet here are some places that are making some progress against it, and what can we learn from them?
I couldn't agree more. I think, so much of the media is either focused on fear-mongering, like there are black violent people out there to get you, and crime, there's a perception, may I just say, promoted by our president, that violent crime is at all-time highs. It's at all-time lows. Violent crime is at all-time lows, people, like a 40-year low. There have been a certain uptick in violent crime in a few cities in the last year, but basically, you're safer than you've been in a long, long time. And that doesn't make it into the media. I think the question of solutions and how to make this thing work better is central to what we're trying to put forward at the Marshall Project, and I do want to say that we now have a commentary section that encourages people to contribute their own op-eds or proposals for how to make the criminal justice system better. Media means the middle. Media is the thing in the middle. And we want to be the place where people with ideas can come and propose, and we can really thrash out policy to move forward. So those of you who are criminal justice nerds in the audience, send us your op-eds. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think, has been the most provocative and interesting panel that I've been to all week, so I appreciate all of you. I live here in Washington, D.C. I'm surprised that none of you have talked about the role of the police and the need for police reform, given the last 5 years of public.
I'm going to fact check you. It's the last 400 years.
The last several years of very, very high profile incidents, and just wondered if you all had comments on police reform.
So the police, like anything, are institutions that thrive on the people that are going into the institution and what they're learning and what they see. In Boston, for example, during white flight and busing, which happened in the mid-70s, the city of Boston also said, police officers, you don't need to live here anymore. You can live outside of our city and come in and police the city, because they didn't want to send their children to schools where there might be black children. Once they did that, once you remove the responsibility of someone who lives in that neighborhood to come in and police it, that proximity, that lack of proximity, then becomes an issue where I'm coming in to occupy your neighborhood. And until we get to a place where we go away from that and we make police responsible for the places that they are policing in, we're going to have a really, really hard time resolving that problem.
The reason I don't spend as much time, or the reason I may not have even brought it up in this conversation, is two reasons. One is, I try not to build organizing and advocacy campaigns around individual cases of anything. Mm-hmm. I think that you can get a highly charged and emotional response from your base and get them to mobilize, and I think it's short-lived. Mm-hmm. And I think people pick sides, and I don't think it's sustainable. And so as someone who's thinking more about organizing and advocacy, the policing space so far has been mostly charged by those very sensationalized, extremely awful, disgusting evidence of police officers murdering people of color and so on. Important stuff, but hard for an advocate to sort of build a campaign around. That's my personal perspective. And at the same time, I give a lot of value to the Black Lives Matter movement and what they've been able to do to create the political space in our country for reform to happen. I don't want to discount that. The other piece for me is that if you spend a lot of time talking about policing and attach it to the conversation about mass incarceration, you give people the assumption that policing has a lot to do with safety. I live in New York. I live in Harlem. I tend to run down Fifth Avenue or Madison. And so I start in Harlem, where you're on Fifth Avenue and things are just falling the hell apart, and, you know, low-income communities. And there's all this evidence of policing. There's guard towers. There's police at the corner. There's the police officer walking the beat. There's stop and frisk. There's quality of life. There's all this other stuff. And then you hit 96th Street. And suddenly it's the most safest area in the city, and you don't see police.
Yep.
And I want to remind people that safety has little to do with police. Police clean up the mess for all the things that we ignore further upstream. And what you get when you get below 96th Street is quality education, safe place to live, access to employment, health care, all the things that we know really create safety. And so it's just a strategic decision on my part to, as an advocate, recognize there are other people doing amazing work in that space, but as someone thinking about mass incarceration, just strategically not introducing it into the conversation, because I think sometimes it leads people down the wrong path.
And I agree, because for every awful shooting that we've seen in the media, there are police who are just doing little things that we don't talk about. Ferguson wasn't about Mike Brown. Ferguson was about everything that you didn't see leading up to Ferguson. And so focusing on those things, and this is my last comment about mass incarceration, we have these really, you know, Kalief Browder, this awful case, this thing that we... It's the highlight of sort of what was going on at Rikers. It divests us of the reality of what is happening every single day, every hour, to men and women across this country, just in courtrooms. There's no movement against prosecutors. And this morning, by lunchtime, I guarantee you that over 1,000 people's lives were irreparably ruined by a decision that prosecutors are making across this country. So we really need to be careful, and I'm glad that Glenn said that, about how do we strategically move this ball forward, where do we focus, and what are the levers?
My name is Leslie Udwin. I'm the founder and CEO of Think Equal, and thank you. You've just segued totally into helping me try to articulate this, and I'm really praying for eloquence here, because I feel this so strongly. I just hope I can make this clear. First, I want to say you are so inspiring. Thank you for your commitment. Thank you for your work and for being so clear, because I've never heard these statistics before, and I'm in this space really caring about this issue. It just strikes me, you're talking about 1 in 3 young Black men who are going to end up incarcerated. What brought me to this space was making a documentary, which actually Meryl Streep called for an Oscar for, so we have a lot in common. But,
nice.
But it was a documentary about violence against women. And the statistics are identical. 1 in 3 women is going to experience violence in her lifetime. 1 in 5 women is going to be a victim of rape or sexual violence. What is the root cause of this? All violence has as its root cause a discriminatory mindset. So the odds are stacked against people of color. The odds are stacked against Tutsis, if you're a Hutu, against women. And it's what we need to stop is discrimination. Mm-hmm. We need to stop inhumanity. Now, I've never known of a more perfect moment in time and perfect window in this country when you have just had elected an enemy of humanity, of humaneness.
This is apolitical, but I appreciate that commentary.
Well, I'm an outsider, so I claim the right.
Yes, we all have the right, even if you're an insider.
But isn't this the time
Yes.
for all of us to join hands and to say civil society has its time now.
Yes.
We have to fight for this because I don't want to see us sitting here in 20 years' time. And we must not forget what Nelson Mandela said, which is no child is born hating.
Right. Thank you for that.
A child has to be taught to hate. Let us teach our children to love. Let us bring social and emotional learning in from the age of three as a compulsory subject, which is what I've dedicated my life to. But let's all solve the root cause and the problem and join forces now.
Thank you very much for that comment. We have 1 minute left. Final thoughts, final ask, final wish. Where are we in 20 years?
Okay, I'll use my final thought to actually respond to this, if you don't mind.
I would love that.
Okay, I'll be brief, though. So as someone who's constantly telling people of privilege that they need to not just identify their privilege and step away from it, but identify it and wield it in support of people of less privilege to accomplish ending mass incarceration, I also spend a lot of time thinking of my own privilege. And where it comes up a lot for me is that women are the most highest rising population of people going to prison in this country. And who do I, what do I as a man have in terms of privilege that that makes women more and more invisible, number one? And number two, what have I been taught by the criminal justice system in terms of the hyper-masculinity that it takes to survive in that system to contribute to violence against women? And I think that when we think about intersectionality and how we solve the issue of mass incarceration, for me, this is a really, really big one, because if we're going to solve mass incarceration, it's because we're going to humanize the people in the system. And I can't think of a better group of folks to do that than women, to be quite honest. I think the biggest mistake the system might have made is to lock up so many women, because now they're coming out and telling stories that elicit compassion from people, stories about being disconnected from their children, having their children taken away, losing their childbearing years, and so on. And yet, as a man in leadership in this space, I'm constantly trying to remind myself of how I sometimes get in the way of that leadership and those stories, and how that actually diminishes the ability to move forward on this issue more quickly. So thanks for bringing that up.
Final thought.
Bless you for what you're doing around the world. This is a global philanthropy forum. You care about issues that are incredibly important in countries where not enough people care about those. And your use of philanthropy to try to solve them is really important. I spent decades of my life concerned about the same issues that you are all over the globe. Don't forget this country. The things that are happening here, as you've heard, are severe, they are intolerable, and they also need your help. If you can do something more on this, the most important human rights issue here on our doorstep, please do.
And I will just say, sort of sitting here thinking about the topics that we've been talking about, children without clean water, children without access to education, children without access to health care, diseases that we thought we've destroyed years ago affecting populations, slavery, incarceration, all of those things are happening here. And it's not something that we should just come together once in a while and talk about and leave inspired. Inspiration indicates that you're going to do something about it. We are a developing nation as much as anyone else because we still have not talked about our history and thought about it in a real way. Somebody said the word, it's painful to read about this stuff. Welcome to the everyday life that people in this country have to lead. And if you're not feeling that pain all the time, ask yourself, maybe because of your privilege and your resource, maybe you should be. And how do you deal with that? How would you heal yourselves? I really, really want to thank our panelists and our audience. You guys get to go on break now. Please return back to the Grand Ballroom at 10:40 a.m. for Identity, Politics, and Media. But first, please, please, please join me in thanking these two incredible people for their comments today.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Adam Foss, founder of Prosecutor Impact, Carol Bogert, president of the Marshall Project, and Glenn Martin, founder and president of Just Leadership USA. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Johnny Good. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.